We're going to bring the meeting to half order. We won't do any official actions until we get a quorum. But in the meantime, Representative Simonston, are you ready? I'll move your bill, Representative Simonston, be held over for possible inclusion, and you can go ahead and however you like. Do you have any amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope that there is an amendment in your packet.
Yep, I see one here. The chair will move the A-15. What's that? Oh, that's right. We can't move it yet until we get a quorum. Hold it close. There we go. We'll hold off and moving the amendment and doing the minutes. But you go ahead and explain your bill as if it was amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. My comments will be very brief, and I'm going to turn it over to testimony. But essentially, Mr. Chair, members, House File 1126 is a continuance of a discussion that we had 2 years ago and years past about a direct appropriation to a community offender reentry program that was originally in Duluth area only. And now with the amendment that you'll consider a little bit later, expands those services to St. Louis County based on the success of the program. But essentially, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to turn this over to Emily, who will introduce herself for the record. But she is the court case manager and coordinator, and we'll talk a little bit about the program and the value of it to not only to Duluth and St. Louis County, but to the state of Minnesota as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to the testifier.
Okay, if we could just take care of a few housekeeping items before. It looks like we got a quorum. Start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Hertas? Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lohmer? Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
Raised, sir.
Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam, Representative Rosenthal,
here.
Representative Schoen, Representative Ward, Representative Winkler, and Representative Zerwas.
Okay, Representative Neuberger, would you move the minutes,
sir,
of April 7th? Representative Neuberger moves the minutes of April 7th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And now we can move House File 1126 to be held over for possible inclusion and bring up the amendment, the A-15-0063 amendment, to get it in the shape the author wants it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, sorry for the interruption. Go ahead with your name and organization and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Emily Edison. I am the Executive Director at SOAR Career Solutions. We're located in Duluth, Minnesota. We provide employment services, but what I'm talking to you about today is mainly our reentry services that we've provided since 2006. According to the Minnesota Department of Corrections 2013 probation survey, we see about 1,800 individuals return back to St. Louis County from incarceration each year. Roughly 240 of those are on intensive supervised release or supervised release. These men and women are faced with the difficulties of reentering back to the community. They need to find housing, secure employment, connect with their mental health and chemical dependency services. And frankly, they don't know where these resources are available to them most of the time. Probation or parole is often their only community link for the ex-offender, but they have high caseloads and are not always able to give a large amount of time to any one case. We do the best as community agencies to meet the needs of ex-offenders, but sometimes there are gaps due to limited resources. At SOAR, we've instilled, I've been doing this for a while, and have had our evidence-based reentry services be really successful. We serve high-risk offenders. We meet with clients in the correctional facility all across the state 2 to 3 months prior to their release, identifying what needs they're going to have when they come out so that we can best prepare prior to the release. We provide then one-on-one case management to help them address the barriers. We connect them with a mentor and or group setting so they can connect back to their community. We provide cognitive change behavioral assessment or behavioral workshops. And we also provide our employment services and trainings, access to post-secondary trainings. Why would you want to reinvest in reentry services? It's because we expanded to serve all of St. Louis County. In 2013, we accessed a federal grant, the Second Chance Act grant, which allowed us to expand our services with, in partnership with Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency. This is allowing us to collaborate on our service delivery as well as using our limited resources. As far as what Minnesota state funding would do, we would be able to keep reentry services in St. Louis County. We would be able to ensure the expansion of countywide reentry services will continue. We will be able to increase countywide community partnerships and the coordination of these services. We can work on a sustainability plan for the countywide reentry program and increase our program capacity and expertise. This also allows for accurate data on a countywide level and allows for better evaluation. Essentially, we will have no reentry services without Minnesota state funding. And just to briefly hand it over to my colleague, Ben Aron, she's going to speak a little bit about the impact this would have on probation and parole in our county.
Hi.
Can you state your name and organization?
Yep. Binner Ron, case manager with the Reentry Program Services through SOAR. Prior to my case manager position that I just recently took, I was actually with Arrowhead Regional Corrections, and most recently I was the probation officer for the Community Sanctions Program. For my personal involvement, I relied heavily on the CORE program, the Reentry Services, just because with the parole agents, I was probation, but with parole agents, their caseloads are often 80 to 100 people, and they get, that includes the supervised release and intensive. Majority of those clients are our clients, and so one of the things that we do that they really appreciate is that we go with the clients. We actually do our intakes at the facilities that they're incarcerated at. So we will go do their intake wherever we need to go prior to them coming out. That's been a huge impact in a positive way for parole. That gives the clients an immediate connection upon their return to community. We grab them within a few days of them being here and get going, and so they already know who we are. So we'll establish that positive connection for them. And anyone will tell you that those first few days that they're back, the fact that we've already established, like I said, that connection with them, it's huge, because that's when they're already thinking in those first few days, oh, I'm home, and then that wears off, and then, you know, they're looking for what they're going to be doing next. So they rely heavily on our reentry program. We also help them with housing, jobs, transportation. We have direct and positive effect on the public safety when our clients are obviously working towards a job. They're going back to school, have other kind of career goals. So as Emily already said, it's kind of a win-win situation for everybody at this point.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says it's a one-time appropriation. What happens in 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, we'll be back in 2 years, and we'll have this very similar conversation. But to maybe expand on that a little bit, I think we briefly talked 2 years ago that, you know, as this program continues and proves its success, and I think that it has, we really need to have a larger discussion about what we do statewide and how we handle these appropriations, because obviously, I mean, we can prove to you the value of this investment from a state perspective in terms of return on investment. So I do think that there's a larger conversation that needs to happen here at some point in time about how we do this going forward.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson. These are great programs that have great return. I'm wondering, are we getting to a point where we're going to have 86 other counties coming to advocate for their particular reentry programs? And I know that the Department of Corrections also plays a role currently in working with counties and working with a lot of the reentry programs that are out there. So if you could just sort of explain why this need is, say, different than a need of that Anoka County or Ramsey County or Olmsted County or other counties might have.
Representative Simons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, you know, I don't think they are different. And I think, you know, hopefully we would see a continued increase in interest in investing these types of dollars in these sorts of programs, because ultimately our goal should be to keep people out of repetition and out of prison. And I think that, as we've seen from this data, that this is a model that could be applied just about anywhere. But I know Commissioner Roy is here, and perhaps, Mr. Chair, if you'll allow, he can just speak a little bit to more of the statewide efforts on this particular topic.
Sure. Commissioner Roy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tom Roy. I'm Commissioner of Corrections. I speak this morning in support of this program and of the philosophy of community collaborations, and I am familiar with this program, especially because of my previous life as director in Duluth. Actually, this program found itself one floor below me in the building I worked out of. I'm also familiar with the program because of a parolee, a very serious offender who had spent the better part of three decades in prison and was released last year on parole under my authority, and he's become affiliated with this program. And I believe in large part because of this program, he is succeeding in northern Minnesota. He's found residence, he's found employment, and he has stabilized after many, many decades in prison. To speak to the larger issue of the department's interest in reentry, we have a major reentry effort going on. We are the recipient of second chance reentry grants. We are in a very serious effort with our transition from prison to the community effort. Some of you on the committee have met with some people from the reinvestment, the Council of State Government, and have actually participated in some of those events. So we are fully committed to the notion that we need to partner with community providers and with county agencies to get our job done. We have far too many people failing upon their effort to reenter society, and programs like this assist those offenders very significantly, and it is money well spent. I cannot speak to the amount. Obviously, it is it's not something that the governor has vetted, nor have I vetted thoroughly, but I can only speak to the efficacy of these types of programs.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if I do the math, roughly $30,000 a year to incarcerate somebody. So if we're able to divert eight individuals from coming back into the system, it's paid for itself. So just comment.
Representative Castaneda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity one time to hear one of your predecessors speak, Orville Pong, and he said as a minimum, it should be our goal to keep these people from coming out any more bitter than when they went in, because as he pointed out, Minnesota doesn't have the death penalty and they're all coming back, or the vast majority of them. That was a minimum. I think what you're trying to do probably is all in our best interests, because frankly, who wants to be the victim of the crime? And if they've got a proven track record, this is probably a pretty good investment. Thank you.
Any members, any more questions? Any comments or a testimony? Any more testifiers? Any comments from the public? Okay, any closing statement, Representative Simons?
My only statement, Mr. Chair, is to thank you and the members of the committee for listening to the bill. I know your target is tight, but I hope that you can find some perhaps room within your target to do something, because I think we all agree that this is an effective program and would be nice to see it continue. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and with that, the chair will move the 1126 to be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
And now We have a House File 1215 by Representative Metza. Are you ready? I've been getting questions on your bill already from law enforcement up there in Duluth and Grand Rapids.
You're keeping us in line, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move House File 1215 to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Metza, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, Representative Molina is home sick with her baby today, so I'm presenting this on her behalf. But I believe it's a very good investment. We used to have a program called Range Women's Advocates who were in the competitive grant process, and it's a five-year process. And so in the interim, they kind of went under, so to speak, and we went from having eight people locally to service northeastern Minnesota to, well, I guess our part of northeastern Minnesota, to three right now. And so we're asking for $100,000 to ride out through the next competitive grant process, at which point we'll enter that again, is the idea. So it'd be $100,000 per year. And I brought down a testifier, and I'm sure she'd have some great things to add.
Ma'am, go ahead with your name and organization and begin.
Sure. My name is Melissa Skaya. I'm the executive director at Advocates for Family Peace. You should also note I'm also the executive director at Domestic Abuse Intervention Programs in Duluth. And so Advocates for Family Peace started in Itasca County and was a partner with Range Women's Advocates for many, many years. And so during the last competitive process, Range Women's Advocates was defunded. And so it's the first I ever heard of. It's actually kind of unheard of. So when we talked with the state staff at that time, they said that it was for two reasons. One, all the grant applications are scored in the state. They said that they got the lowest score in the state. And then also that they had some internal financial control problems. So they tried to fundraise for a couple months, and it just wasn't working out. So they reached over to us in Itasca County and asked if we consider merging. They were being sued by a former employee, so we could not merge with them. So they disbanded, essentially. They're no longer a nonprofit, and then we expanded our service area. So because the competitive process, you know, was over, that we couldn't get any ongoing state money from the state of Minnesota. So we applied for VAWA funding from the state of Minnesota. We were able to get a competitive grant for 2 years, but those are competitive grants. They're not continuation grants. And then the United Way, bless their hearts and souls, they just came through amazingly thus far, but they've told us, you know, we can only do so much. But they gave us $75,000 twice, which is unheard of, you know, for their fundraising locally. We got, you know, we went to the Northland Foundation, the Blandon Foundation, you know, all the small city foundations to try and help us. And we're about exhausted our resources. So we've never, ever asked for money before. We're not here asking to expand, you know, prove to you. We're asking for basic, for one of the largest service areas in the state. There's parts of our county service area we haven't even been to, frankly, all the way to the northern part of the county, up, you know, by Canada. So it's a huge gap. Well, we have three people who work for us right now. Only two of them, based on grant agreement, can work with adults. So we have two staff working with 200 to 300 adult victims of domestic violence. Of course, we're an area that's not immune to homicides, you know, domestic violence homicides in our area. In fact, one of the last ones in our service area happened to be my best friend's brother happened to stand in front of a victim. A man came into a local establishment to shoot his wife, and he stood in front of her, and he died. Two others were injured. That was a terrible tragedy. My best friend lived with us for 5 weeks during that time because she lived out of state. So you all know the tragedies. I don't have to remind you of all that. But the important thing I just want you to know is that, you know, we have you know, we haven't had any problems with our finances, you know, with the state or any other funder. And so we have a good track record. We're also a national training agency. So I'm certified as an expert in the state of Minnesota in domestic violence. So our track record's good. We're asking for base money to help us get through to the next five-year competitive process. That's our request.
Any members, questions?
quiet bunch today.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Metza. And if I missed this, I apologize, and if this is the hard question, but why? What happened that we came to this need today, that you need the gap funding?
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the history that I understand, the transition kind of happened right when I was in my first term, and the organization ran into some trouble in how it was being run, and essentially, you know, kind of got the rug pulled out from underneath them for that trouble. And we tried a few other options locally. They've worked with a lot of community partners, and so now we're here trying to ride out through the next 2 years, I believe it is.
Yeah. So just to be clear, you know, it's a separate nonprofit. You know, that I just want to be clear about that. So
thank you. Totally, that's exactly what I was trying to get you to say.
It's a totally separate nonprofit. And, you know, they were longstanding our partners. You know, they trained us early on. Their founders were really well-respected. They went through a transition. You know, their staff retired. They had some changes. So, but it was a totally different organization. And so they couldn't make it, you know, after having no state money. The no state money just, it was a large percentage of their budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I was just trying to clarify is that you're a different organization that came in to take over after a different organization had problems, and now you need the gap to deal with until the next process comes in so that your group can get that grant.
Yeah, and our strategy has been to come to the state last. I mean, we tried to do as much as we could locally. And I also just want to say, because I mentioned at the beginning, is also we're considering a merger with the Duluth Domestic Violence Program. So much of our work, you know, is, so not the Safe Haven Shelter, the local domestic violence program there. So much of our work is the same in northern St. Louis County, southern. So you also know that a local foundation is also paying for us to explore a merger. In fact, we had a meeting yesterday. So we're trying every strategy to be efficient with our funds and just fill in the gap. Because we can't apply for the money until the state opens the process again.
Okay. Members' questions. Any comments from the public? Representative Metza or Mrs. Gaia, is it?
Yes.
Any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your consideration, committee members. I know, again, it's tight budgets right now, and we really appreciate your consideration and looking at the funding for this program.
I already got emails from the Grand Rapids Chief and Sheriff Vic already on your bill. All right, well, thank you very much. And with that, House File 1215 will be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, Representative Schoen, House File 1500, and you can move your own bill if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I move that House File 1500, and since we're asking for money, are we asking for it to be, is this an inclusion?
Yes, I forgot to ask you where you wanted to go. Held over for possible inclusion.
So that's my motion.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and members, today I'm asking that you consider House File 1500 as a bill that seeks an annual appropriation for $250,000 from the general fund to go to OJP for a critically important service for our immediate and long-term emotional support and assistance for family of loved ones who have died by homicide, suicide, overdose, or accident. Currently, you all have a folder of some information. You've seen some, if you go through the letters, many of you may have gotten personally from your constituents about those that have had to use this service. This is a nonprofit group that operates out of the St. Paul, Minneapolis police departments. And that by operating out of there, I mean they're housed there. And they provide services all over the state of Minnesota and all of our jurisdictions. And really what they do is a one-of-a-kind program here. If I, for some of our high-profile crimes and incidences that we've had in Cottage Grove or any of your communities, these folks help us as a resource with the families. And basically, they go to the family, and we can guide them, and they can help us understand the process or help the families understand the process. But I'm going to let you hear from some folks that we have here today to talk about the program, to talk about their experiences and why this is so important and why this is gotten such broad support, and when you hear about this, I think you'll understand even better. So, who's up first?
Welcome back, Mr. Choi. Do you want to start off first with your name and title?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. And first, let me start off by thanking Representative Schoen and this great group of bipartisan co-authors of this bill. I really appreciate it. And I'm really pleased to be here to offer my support for House File 1500 because I think it's so critically important. You know, as the county attorney, one of the hardest parts of my job is to meet with the surviving family members when we have a homicide situation in Ramsey County. And oftentimes those family members live all across the state of Minnesota or our region. They're not necessarily just from Ramsey County. And I'm always, when I meet with surviving family members, friends, loved ones, I'm always at a loss for words because I'm the gravity of that moment, because no matter what I say, no matter what happened in that in the criminal justice system process, a conviction, a sentence, it doesn't bring back their loved one. And one of the things I've come to realize is that as a community, as a state, we can do a lot more in helping these families, because it's surviving is not just about getting through that court process or that situation or that moment. It's really about what happens after all of that. And one of the best parts of my job is actually running into some of these family members maybe a year or two later, and oftentimes they're still struggling with all of the pain, but they're in a little bit of a better place. And oftentimes it's because of organizations like Survivor Resources. I've heard from so many people who participate in those survivor groups. And so that in the work that the organization does, I think it's so critical to help crime victims. And these crime victims are the surviving members of homicide cases. But also in our communities, we have drug overdose, suicides, all of that. And it's just, I think, just very critical. It's not just about reparations that we as a state provide for crime victims, but I also think it's also to help victims ongoing after an incident has occurred, a process has occurred in the criminal justice system, and I know that law enforcement throughout the state is very supportive of this, because as Representative Schoen talked about, you know, when they have to come to a situation, once they have a chaplain come, the police investigators can do their work, and then have a group like Survivor Resources really provide all of the help that a family needs to get through that difficult time. I just think is so critical as a part of our infrastructure in terms of what we do to respond to these horrible things that happen in our community. So I just would encourage all of you members to support this bill, because I do think it's important for the entire state, and the funding would, I think, be able to really provide the ability for this organization to really have great impact across the state of Minnesota, not just in the Twin Cities area. So thank you.
Ma'am, if you want to go ahead and say a few words, your name and title.
I'm Margaret McAbee, the Executive Director, and I'm basically here to ask questions. However, Leanne Block is here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Lee Block, and I'm here on behalf of Survivor Resources. In September of 2004, during my daughter's weekend visitation with her father, he fatally shot her and then killed himself. When I got notification from the St. Paul Police Department shortly following that visit, I got a call from the St. Paul Police Chaplain, or he actually came to my apartment, and he gave me Margaret McAbee's card. And before I had a chance to call her, she contacted me and made herself available to help me and my family. When you're dealing with a homicide, there's a lot of questions, and needless to say, that was the worst time in my life. And Margaret actually was able to work with law enforcement, the funeral director, the coroner's office, things that I wouldn't have been able to do without her help. She had a lot of contacts. And if she didn't have an answer for me, she would find out and she would get back to me as soon as she could. I began attending support groups on Monday evenings that were free of charge, and one thing that made me feel that it was so unique was that the facilitators that ran these groups were actually survivors of, I was in the homicide group. So it was very meaningful for me to be able to talk to these groups of people that had the same kind of experiences as I did. That time in my life, I felt like I was in my own little world, and I was pretty much in robotic mode. But because of the help from these people, I was able to have some meaning in my life. And I spent a lot of time in Margaret's office. I volunteered in her office. My daughter was my life, and I felt like I had no purpose. Michaela is only 5 years old when she was killed, and she was 2 months shy of her sixth birthday, actually, in the day that she was supposed to start kindergarten. We were attending her funeral. 5 months later, our mom was murdered at her home in Aiken, Minnesota. Her death, our family felt, was suspicious, and thanks to Margaret and law enforcement from St. Paul, she was able to contact the authorities in Brainerd, Minnesota. And a year after my mom's murder, I asked Margaret if she would accompany our family to my mom's murder trial, which she did, thankfully. We had an advocate up north, but unfortunately, I felt that she was there for her own benefit and not ours. Margaret was able to kind of guide us through the court process. She gave us worst-case scenarios, best-case scenarios, and when we were sitting in that courtroom during the trial, I felt as if I was watching someone else's life. I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for Survivor Resources. A few years later, going through my grief process, I began co-facilitating children's grief groups. And at first, when Margaret invited me to do that, I didn't think I was going to be able to because I had a really hard time being around children. But when I would sit with those little innocent children, I would look at them and think, that could be my daughter sitting in that group if my ex would have had his way because he wanted to kill me. I loved working with clients and having contact, and as I got more strong, Margaret gave me actually a feeling of worth again. When you're in an abusive marriage like I was, you're brought way down, but I got my self-respect back, and I wanted to give back to people as they had given to me. Eventually, Margaret asked me if I would want to join the staff of Survivor Resources, which I was honored to do. And I did work there in 2008, and I felt like I finally had a purpose in life. I was helping clients who had been at the early stages of their grief, as I was, and that gave me a great feeling. And I can tell you that when you go through a horrific experience like this, you don't think that you're going to be able to go on in life, but I finally felt like I could provide some hope to someone else because I'm a two-time homicide survivor. And unfortunately, because of funding, I was let go at Survivor Resources. And that was another devastating thing for me in my life because I thought the one thing that I knew that I was good at, I didn't have that anymore. So I've had a lot of adjustment in my life over these past 10 years. And I can honestly say through the Service of Remembrances that Survivor Resources has and the walks at Como Park, we're able to remember our loved ones. And I never thought that I would be able to laugh again. But when I get with these group of people, these facilitators and the people that have lost their loved ones, it keeps our loved one's spirit alive. And that's very important to me. And because of these tragedies, I've been given opportunities to speak with domestic abuse victims. I've spoken at the Lionel Lakes prison to inmates. I've spoken to the new recruits at the St. Paul Police Department, and I shared our experiences with them to tell them what was helpful and what wasn't. I've spoken with troubled teens at Hennepin County Homeschool, and a lot of these were young men that were in serious trouble for crimes, abusing their children, and I can't tell you how much it meant to me when I would get letters of thanks in the mail from these young men saying that they would treat their the mother of their children better because they were going to remember my story. This is just a small piece of, it's hard to put everything into words that I want to say, but I believe it is so vital to keep this program going. There are so many people who have benefited from this, and there are so many more people, unfortunately, that are going to need these types of services. So I hope that you consider funding this bill. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for being here and for your moving testimony. Appreciate it. So far, any questions, folks, from the members? Any questions? Yeah, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm looking at the documentation, it appears that there hasn't been funding, at least from the state level or the county level, for the past several years. Where's the funding or the desire to operate come from? Or are there some outside resources that you've been able to obtain in the past several years?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Survivor Resources gets a continuation grant through the Office of Justice Programs. So we get $66,000 per year. That will again become competitive, I think, this year. So that amount may change. It has also declined some over the past few years due to cuts. We are embedded with the Minneapolis and St. Paul Homicide Units. Those, they provide in-kind services for housing. We use their office machines, their computers, internet, telephone lines, and so forth. The rest of our funding comes through fundraising events and individual contributions. We get about $150,000 in contributions and money that we raise.
Okay, members, questions? Any comments or testimony? You got another test part?
Yeah, one more if you don't mind, Mr.
You bet.
Chair.
All right. Go ahead and give us your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Catherine Johnson. I am the commander of the Violent Crimes Investigations Division for the Minneapolis Police Department. In that capacity, I oversee several units. Obviously, the most applicable to today's discussion is our homicide unit in Minneapolis. We have a great advantage in handling sudden violent deaths in Minneapolis, and it's one we share with the city of St. Paul, and that advantage is Survivor Resources. We've benefited from this unique partnership in many ways. Survivor Resources was there helping families struggling with the aftermath of the Accent signage shooting. They did what cops couldn't. They took the time to help begin the emotional healing process for the survivors of that incident. They helped family members begin the paperwork process that is an unfortunate side effect of an event like Accent signage. Survivor Resources was there when the 35W bridge collapsed. And because of the trusted relationships they had built with the Minneapolis Police Department, the St. Paul Police Department, the staff of Survivor Resources were the ones with access and the ones prepared to help the survivors who were on the bridge that day and the families of those who died that day. More recently, Survivor Resources was there to help our officers notify the parents of a University of Minnesota student that their daughter would not be coming home. In a situation where video put a clear end to our investigation, we were able to do more than simply notify a grieving family and walk away. Because of this partnership, we were able to give them resources, to offer them support, and to provide comfort in ways that would not be possible without the unique relationship we have built with Survivor Resources. One of the key goals of the Minneapolis Police Department is to build and enhance public trust. By giving proper care to families after a sudden violent death, we have the opportunity to build that trust in the most trying of circumstances. Our job is focused on investigating crimes and providing closure by identifying and arresting the perpetrators of violent crimes. With the help of Survivor Resources, we can do more than that for the citizens of Minneapolis. We can help provide care and support to those who have suffered such tragic losses. Supporting this bill and giving Survivor Resources the opportunity to apply for the funds that it sets aside will allow us to not only continue that relationship, but also to grow it and expand their relationship with law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time today.
Questions? Okay, any members from the public wish to comment? Seeing none, Representative Schoen, would you like to make any closing statement on your
Yeah, vote? Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate you taking the time to hear us out today, and I guess, you know what, I want to make it clear that this is not just a Minneapolis and St. Paul program. You know, if you're in Elk River, if you're in Willmar, Buffalo, these resources are available to you, and they're gonna come to you. And I can give you I'll give you two personal examples. So several years back, and a lot of these are high profile. You know, down in Cottage Grove, we had an incident where a strange husband murdered his wife, and they had two small children, both too small to even ever remember their parents. And these two were in their early 20s, and these are the folks that, that her parents are now raising those two young kids. And to be able to have to go tell these parents in the first place what happened when we're working, that, you know, this is your loved one's not coming home. And our job is to continue the investigation and make sure things are done right. And there are things here that this group does that not only provides the training to us to how to handle the victims and speak with the victims, but to get the resources that they will need as well. And then another incident that was that I was involved with in a park off 94 and St. Croix Trail. And teenagers from your school district, one murdered his girlfriend and then shot himself. And when we got to the scene to do the investigation, out came the father of the son, or his the male that was involved. And when the deputy, when I arrived with my squad, the deputy is walking this guy out from the park who had just seen the crime scene, what his son did to himself and did to his then girlfriend, and he was the color of this sheet of paper. And I can't imagine what that parent, not only that he found that crime scene, but what they're going to live with the rest of their life. And how do you understand what you're going to need to go through, and to have people that have had the experience bring you together and help you through that, it's invaluable. Because as you know, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the next day there's more calls waiting for us when we go back to work. And we can't be there for those families like these people can. And this is worth every dime to every single person in the state of Minnesota if you go through something. And if your loved one or your child should have something happen while they're at the University of Wisconsin, but you're a Minnesota resident, they're going to help you. This doesn't have borders. As long as you're a Minnesota resident and you're here and you need the help, we're going to give it to you. Thank you for your consideration. I renew my motion that House File 1500 be laid over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, somebody has raised their hand behind you there.
Come on up.
You start with your name and who you represent, or if you're just here by yourself.
My name is Leanne Hofstrom, and I'm I belong to Survivor Resources. On November 15th of 2013, my son Ted was involved in a double homicide. He died by police-assisted suicide. And that night when the sheriff came, he gave me, by the time they left, he gave me this then mellow brochure that stated what you do. You call this funeral home, you call whatever, whatever. And on the back, he said, the most important phone call you're going to need to make and that will save your life is Survivor Resources. I called Margaret, and I called Julie, the other lady, and I was actually at Target, and they talked to me for like 45 minutes. And there's not a time of day, 24/7, that I couldn't call Margaret or Julie. And my husband and my younger son joined Survivor Resources in January of 2014. 10.5 months later, my husband left in the middle of the night. And that was on a Sunday night, and I went to my therapist, and then I called our St. Anthony Police Department and talked to a friend of mine. And he said, Leanne, there's nothing we can do to find Todd for 72 hours. Well, that night I walked into Survivor Resources, and one of the facilitators, my son's facilitator, looked at me, and I was as green as can be. And I just about collapsed, and he said, what's wrong? And I said, Todd's missing. My husband went to Survivor Resources with us. Margaret came down and brought me upstairs to her office, and we sat for the hour and a half, and she made a list of 17 things. And she let one of the other ladies through Survivor Resources go to the St. Anthony Police Department with me. And because of that, my husband was on the missing persons immediately. I would have had to wait 72 hours. And because of that, my husband was gone for 17 days, but they were with me. Everybody in our survivors group, I belong to the suicide group, was with us, was with me, with my son, and without them, I swear to you, I would not be here today. I have made friends that we walk a walk that I hope none of you will ever have to walk. We walk a walk that without her and her support and survivor resources, some of us would not be here today. My family, they love us, but they don't know how to help us. Only us that have survived what we've gone through know how to help one another. And honestly, without Margaret, I can call her all the time, anybody. So I beg all of you, I know money's tight everywhere, and we do what we can to get money to help. But you can't put a price tag on our loved ones' loss or a price tag on what this facility does for us. So I guess I'm begging you, for the loss of my son and my husband's memory and all of us, I just can't say enough, and I just can't beg enough, and I'm not too proud to beg. So I thank you, Chair, and all of you for your time and your support, and I thank her. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate you coming in. Okay. Members, questions, nothing from the public. Representative Schoen, I think you already made your statement and moved your bill. So with that, we'll hold over House File 1500 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Representative O'Neill, House File 1088. Representative O'Neill, you can move your bill, and then I see you have an amendment after.
I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1088 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I do have amendment, the A1. And if I could, Chair, I'd like to move the A1 and include that in the text of the bill as a whole.
Okay. Representative O'Neill moves amendment A1. And all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative O'Neill, go ahead however you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm very proud to have with me two women from my community that are leaders in our community. And I've got Jennifer Meister from the Buffalo Hospital. She's our president in the community I live in. And then next door we have Mary Ellen Wells, who's the administrator for the Monticello Hospital. And also behind me, I've got someone from the Minnesota, Matt Anderson, who will be coming up to speak in just a minute from the Minnesota Hospital Association. And we're here today because of grave concerns within the hospitals about workplace violence. And so the president and the administrator here of the two local hospitals in my district are here to talk about their concerns about workplace violence and a solution. This is not the one and only solution, but a solution to some of the workplace violence that their staff have been experiencing. And very simply put, what we want to do is put a hospital into a patient care zone similar to what a school would be or a park would be or a drug treatment facility would be, and thereby increasing the penalties for those that commit crimes within those walls of the hospital. The other component of it would be to if an offender comes from a jail or a prison into the hospital for treatment, and instead of it being a concurrent sentence, it would be consecutive, and so it would be enhanced penalties for that too. So if they assault one of their staff, and they do get people with, in Buffalo we have the Wright County Jail, and just to the north of us we have the St. Cloud prison, so they do experience that quite a bit, and that's been a big issue. So with that, I'd actually like to turn it over to them to have them explain a little bit more what's been happening in our hospitals here locally.
Okay, whoever would like to begin, your name and organization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Ellen Wells, and I can speak with experience on this topic since I've been a leader for over 30 years at hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Currently, I'm the administrator, like Representative O'Neill said, of CentraCare Health Monticello, which is a 39-bed hospital with a very active emergency room and an attached 89-bed skilled nursing facility. My colleague Jennifer and I come to this committee today to discuss an unfortunate yet important issue that healthcare facilities are facing. As you know, healthcare workers are asked to provide services to people in need. We ask them to come to work with all of their energy focused on delivering the best care possible. However, it's become increasingly clear that rising violence in our communities has entered our hospitals, making it critical that we take steps to create an environment that is safe and arm our staff with the necessary tools to mitigate any unsafe situations. This legislation is an important piece to the actions being taken to improve the safety in our facilities. This alone, however, will not solve all of the problems. Many steps are being taken, such as increased security and alarms, which my colleague Jennifer will address more specifically. We believe that this bill will go a long way in conjunction with the steps being taken to create a culture of safety for our staff and those we serve. The aim of this legislation is to treat hospitals, healthcare settings where people may stay for extended periods of time, to similarly to school property. For many years, Minnesota law has recognized the important status of schools, parks, public housing, and chemical treatment centers as places of unique concern with respect to certain criminal activity. These safe zones were created in law because of particularly vulnerable people who depend on those settings and the increased social harm caused by certain criminal activities in those areas. While we wish all of society were less prone to violence, we must recognize that healthcare facilities are even more susceptible to criminal violent activities and deserve to be treated accordingly. House File 1088 is designed to expand upon existing laws to recognize that patients, employees, and visitors to healthcare facilities are particularly vulnerable to certain crimes. What might otherwise constitute a worrisome act of violence in a restaurant, for example, could be life-threatening to hospital patients in an ICU or in the emergency department. Specifically, CentraCare Health Monticello employees have been encouraged to report acts of violence so we can better understand the issue and to accurately track the prevalence. As a result, in the past year, we reported 33 acts of violence in our facility. While approximately half relate to behavioral issues, there remain many incidents where people enter our facilities and threaten our staff and volunteers through threatening words and actions. For example, we've had a patient's family member enter his room and lash out at staff who tried to intervene in a scuffle with another family member. Luckily, no physical damage was done, but this staff member suffered a very stressful situation. Minnesota's hospitals and health systems are committed to continuing our efforts to prevent violence, and when it does occur, respond as quickly and appropriately as possible for everyone involved so that hospitals can remain places of safety and healing. Jennifer will now provide some more further specific examples related to violence and steps that hospitals are taking to create safer environments for caregivers, patients, residents, and their family members.
All right, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Meister, and I'm the president of Buffalo Hospital in Buffalo, Minnesota. We're a regional medical center that cares for about 70,000 people annually. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1088. I'd also like to thank Representative O'Neill for bringing forward this legislation. She's a leader who cares deeply about the people in our community and, like me, about the safety of the staff and the patients at my hospital. I'm sad to say that we've seen an increase in the number and severity of safety incidents at Buffalo Hospital and in healthcare facilities around the state. There's no one reason for the violence trend we're seeing, but some of the contributing factors are a lack of facilities for detox and substance abuse management. EDs, like mine, have become a default place for patients with needs. Lack of mental health facilities and services for people in crisis. patients with other medical conditions that leave them agitated, like dementia. And then, as you know, law enforcement resources are stretched very, very thin. At Buffalo Hospital, we've made a commitment to our staff and patients to reduce the risk of violence. Mary Ellen and other hospital leaders across the state are taking similar measures. We've doubled our number of security guards. We've invested in conflict de-escalation training for our staff. We train and we retrain and we retrain our staff on how to respond when a patient is threatening themselves or others in an act of violent event. We've modified our facility to include safe rooms and a seclusion room. We've installed security buttons at registration and nursing desks for staff to call a code green. And our staff report every event, like Mary Ellen talked about, and we investigate them to see how we can better protect our staff and patients. All the measures we have taken have required an enormous investment of time and resources, and I've estimated that we've spent over $2 million on safety initiatives at Buffalo Hospital over the last 4 years. It's a significant investment. However, it's absolutely the right thing to do to keep our staff and patients safe. Here's some stories of many stories, as Mary Ellen talked about. There's many reported every year. A code green was called to our emergency department. A patient was yelling and threatening staff. The patient threatened the security officer that he would blank him up. I won't use the word. Then he attempted to push back the staff member, striking him in the left shoulder. He continued to make threats that he would hunt them down and get them when they're not at work. So those staff members leave there feeling absolutely afraid for their lives. Another example, an x-ray tech was imaging an intoxicated patient. The worker was standing at the side of the scanner table, and the patient lifted his leg and kicked the employee in the back of the head. A code green was called, and the patient was subdued. Again, the employee was injured while trying to provide care to that patient. I could share many more examples of the physical and verbal abuse on our staff each day. We work every day to create a culture of safety at Buffalo Hospital. We involve our unions, our staff, our physicians, and community partners. House File 1088 is an important step in the right direction to create community expectations that hospitals are for healing and to let our staff know that they're fully supported as they provide care. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Other testifiers, Representative O'Neill? Thank you, ma'am.
With that, we could answer questions. I have someone from the Hospital Association to speak specifically to the bill and any questions that we would have.
All right. Members, Representative Ward, did you have one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I really support your work on this. I'm wondering if we have any information from the other medical associations, from MNA, or especially MNA, but the any of the other medical professional associations on their take on this bill and what they would like to see happen? And then I've got a couple of other questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm Senior Vice President for Regulatory and Strategic Affairs for the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Representative. We have had discussions with the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, Leading Age of Minnesota, the Hospice Association. Most of these organizations have indicated that they don't oppose the bill in any way. The Minnesota Nurses Association has another workplace violence-oriented bill that that they are working on, and we have been working to try to find common ground around that. In addition, prior to this legislation coming forward, last year a multi-stakeholder group, including MHA and the Minnesota Nurses Association, worked through the Minnesota Department of Health to come up with a workplace violence roadmap or best practices. And a lot of that work was reflected in Ms. Meister's testimony about how to create physical environments that are safer, how to train staff to de-escalate situations, identify situations that may become violent, and then how to de-escalate those before there is violence, and then really creating what you've heard today also is creating the culture that you have to report everything. For many, many years, staff took the notion that getting hit, getting spit on, it's just part of the job. You know, I'm working in the ER, people come in, that's just part of the job, and they wouldn't report it. And so what we're really trying to do is get cultural change that these things need to be reported. So we've done that work. I can't say that any of those organizations have this as a priority, and I don't want to speak on their behalf, but we have been in communication with them.
Okay, Representative Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. My younger son is an ER doctor, and his wife is an ER nurse. And so I've been hearing these things for many years, and even when my son was in training and was a paramedic, dealing with whether it was alcohol or but the abusive behavior, and had some communication with both of them about this particular bill. So they coach and help me understand, but I have some really serious concerns just as a parent. The safety for our patients, all of our patients, and for the staff amounts to combat pay sometimes, or combat situations for them. And so the prevention piece is really high on my list. How do we prevent the situations like the one last summer? And I understand that you've been working really hard to do an assessment and create new pathways to do this. So I was thinking about the bad behavior, and one of the things I know about healthcare people is that they're really good at distinguishing between just bad behavior, the abusive language, all of that kind of people who are, they're not feeling well, they're not at their best, but that does not excuse bad behavior. And that sets up something within the healthcare provider. It takes something away from them. It really can be harmful, and doesn't create an environment that's helpful to everyone else. And then it goes from there to really bad and dangerous. So I'm wondering about the training you mentioned, training for people. My experience with over many years, aside from my family situations, that cuts in lots of areas amounted to cuts in security. And so I'm really curious about the training. Who are we hiring as security guards? How available are they? So you push a button. Are there, it's going to depend on how large the facility is, how many there are. But I'm sure that's part of your study. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about what you've learned about that and what kind of training. I mean, if we're going to have someone who's fit and able, Representative Schoen, mm-hmm. who really knows how to respond, as opposed to someone who maybe not physically or in training ready to respond to the kinds of things that we've got to deal with now. What's happening with training?
Representative Dean, was that a question?
It was a question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are for the Hospital Association perspective, this bill is important, and we think of the public policy approach, as others have testified, it's not the solution, but it's an approach. Our focus really is on the work that you described, the training, learnings from events that do happen, creating better ways to decrease violent acts from ever happening, and when they do happen, mitigate the impacts. Those are things that we feel like we need to do. Legislation is not necessarily the approach for that, although if you're looking to fund it, we'd certainly be interested in allocations. But seriously, it's something that our members and Hospital Association take very seriously, and we are continuing to work on it. It is also not a problem unique to Minnesota, and so we are working with the American Hospital Association, hospital state associations around the country to try to learn from their practices as well. As a portion of your question, you're absolutely right. Each hospital is different, and each hospital has different levels of risk, different levels of resources, different levels of approaches. Hennepin County Medical Center in downtown Minneapolis has had trained security, some of which have tasers that they are trained with, and now have an agreement with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office to have a sheriff's deputy on staff at the hospital as well. You take that situation to Grand Marais, one of the smallest, most remote hospitals, they simply don't have the resources to have that level of security. And yet, so what they do is they work closely with their local law enforcement to be able to have law enforcement respond in as quickly as possible, and then training their staff. And oftentimes staff are not, not all staff are able to deal with the violent actor on a one-to-one sort of basis, and that's where the de-escalation training comes in. And when that doesn't work, it's about creating as much safety as possible, which may be backing away, leaving a patient, a violent patient or a visitor in an area, hopefully a confined area, and then you know we'll have stories from CEOs about the damage that gets done to the facilities, to other stuff. But it is a difficult situation. The other thing I'd like to say is it's not always in the emergency room. We have maternity areas where people come in and where you think that everything is happy and wonderful and this great experience, and violent acts occur there. Areas in other areas of the hospital where patients are staying overnight, multiple nights, no expectation of violence, and yet because of anesthesia or other issues, they may have dementia that's onset with no risk factors and start acting out. And so in all of those situations, those alarm buttons, the code greens, the ability to respond as quickly as possible is unfortunately the best that we have now in an environment that's open 24/7, open at all times, and dealing with a range of unpredictable behavior.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill for this bill. I have a couple questions. I understand 100% the issue of the assaults and the danger and the violence piece. I'm struggling with the enhancement of the controlled substance component of this. I mean, I'm thinking of an individual who may have overdosed and they have drugs in their pocket and they come in to the ER room and it's found that not only are they going to be charged for the drug possession crime, but there's also an enhancement now. So if you could sort of help me out to understand why you've included the controlled substance pieces as part of this bill, as well as the issue of assaults.
Whoever would like to go, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. The controlled substance aspects of the bill are not intended to be the situation where a patient is brought in and happens to have controlled substances on them at the time. That is a frequent occurrence, and those substances are removed. Law enforcement and the hospital have to account for those, and typically law enforcement is the end possessor of those, or else the hospital has to waste them. So those are not the situations that we are looking at for this. The situations that we are trying to address are where people are either trying to bring illegal drugs into the hospital to get them to a patient, to get them to wherever, or more often where people are trying to take either steal or divert illegal drugs from the hospital. Hospitals have a large number of narcotics and opioids that are sought after. And so those kind of crimes. And then the other situations that unfortunately a lot of our hospitals have are people who wait outside the emergency room and approach patients as they can't come out, asking what prescriptions they have and if they could purchase those prescriptions.
Representative Dean.
So as a follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would also apply to hospital staff then as well. So those penalties would be enhanced for them as well. Correct.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Dean, there is no distinction between who the offender is, whether they are an employee, a visitor, anything like that. It would be the same as any other drug possession law.
Representative Dean.
So just the last, I, you know, I'd like to say that you've alleviated my concern, but you really haven't. I mean, you know, addiction is a public health issue, and we're now continuing to criminalize and enhance it even more. I don't know what you would do to the bill to address that, but I just have some concerns that we're continuing to escalate the criminalization of drug addiction and some of the things that happen. I understand 100% completely about the issue of assaults and, you know, being in a safe workplace and just struggling. Personally, I'm struggling with the issue of the enhanced criminality of addiction here.
Mr. Chair.
Answer, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, there's already on the books protections around drug abuse treatment centers, are zones of areas where these drug offenses are also enhanced. And the other element, and it's not a perfect element, it's probably not going to satisfy everything, is that all of these enhancements are discretionary for the judge. And so if the case goes through and the judge is then left at a sentencing hearing distinguishing between the person who is accosting patients as they leave the emergency room and the person who has been addicted, has been going to the hospital to get treatment, and on their way out of the hospital for whatever reason is arrested, you know, the judge can make those distinctions. Unfortunately, working in the criminal law statutes, we don't have a way of, at least at this point, of in language trying to distinguish between those kind of cases. So it's imperfect, I understand.
Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean covered some of what I wanted to talk about. And I guess, you know, we all want patients and staff to be as safe as possible, and I applaud you for your intent and for the bill and for the most part. I guess my question has to do with the patients that are being seen, mental health patients, patients that might be on medication that might act a certain way. And I understand that these patients may not be acting in their current or best mind frame. And so I was wondering about the enhancements as well. And do you really feel that people who are being treated for mental health or on these drugs, that the enhancements will help security or safety?
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think from the Hospital Association's perspective and our members, I think the short answer is no, that the incidence of people with mental health issues or are on some other substance when they come in, that they are not really in control and making those kind of decisions anyway. And as earlier testifiers indicated, that's roughly about 50% of the events that are happening. Those cases are not being prosecuted today. Nothing in this law or in this bill would change the whether or not those patients are prosecuted either. So that those cases typically are not reported to police. We still want our employees to report them as incidents that happen, but those incidences typically are not reported to police. If they are reported to police, police generally do not prosecute them because of the mental state of the defendant that you need to prove in order to be able to convict them of the crime. And so those cases are already winnowed out in our criminal justice system today. We don't think this bill will do anything to change that.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is probably for Representative O'Neill. My question is, or let me just, I'll just back up a step. I think we have a that we have to pass if we're going to increase criminal penalties, at least in my mind. And I just tried to kind of write down the things that I think need to be addressed in order to decide that we should increase criminal penalties. Number one, that we are somehow unable to charge individuals under current law based on their conduct or new situations are arising, that there's somehow some flaw in our statutory crime or punishment scheme that would make it difficult to charge these most difficult cases. Number two, evidence that the penalty will have some kind of deterrent effect or have some kind of impact on the actual behavior that we're concerned about. And number three, I think in this case, evidence that there's actually increasing levels of violence that warrants a different kind of response in the criminal justice system. So as I look at those three things, I just wonder if you have information about any of them that would be helpful in looking at this committee's point of view, which is whether we should enhance criminal penalties based on these, you know, obviously deplorable and unfortunate situations that are occurring.
Who would like to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, with respect to those criteria, current laws, this bill amends already existing laws. It doesn't create any new crimes. So by that definition, there is a way to charge these offenses now. The Hospital Association believes that the sentences that are available do not necessarily recognize the vulnerability of the environment where the crime is being committed, which is the same reason why we have enhanced penalties for school zones, park zones, public housing zones, chemical treatment center zones. And that is that an individual act between a, for example, a visitor and a staff member has different consequences for all of the other patients on that unit who now have the stress and fear of whether or not they are safe in the hospital. The other example, one of the aspects of the bill is enhanced sentence for a bomb threat at a hospital. A bomb threat to a hospital where patients have to be evacuated puts all of those patients, particularly ICU patients, in literally life or death situation. A bomb threat to a shopping mall, not a good thing, not anything we want to have happen, but it's not as life-threatening as it would be at a hospital. And so from the current law's perspective, what we're trying to do is recognize the unique vulnerability of the people that are there. As a deterrent effect, deterrence is always very difficult to be able to measure and define. And for a lot of the offenses that are happening or a lot of the violence that's happening in hospitals, any law is probably not going to have a deterrent effect because the person making the decision or making the action is not thinking about the consequences. On the other hand, when the state made school zones and park zones and public housing zones and chemical treatment center zones, patient safety zones, there was a cultural shift around signage, around where people were conducting certain activities. And I don't have statistics, I don't have the availability for that, but from a cultural perspective, it seems that those places now are regarded differently with respect to certain offenses. So I can't say for sure that it's going to have a deterrent effect, but that is part of the reason for having that. Third issue that you had was evidence of rising violence, and that is definitely true. There is statistics both in Minnesota and around the country that the level of violence, both in number of cases and the intensity of the violent acts that are happening in hospitals, has been increasing and increasing dramatically.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Mr. Anderson, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. I understand. I think the last two points are the strongest. I just sort of have a feeling that I'm not sure if it's because we designated school zones as being a place for enhanced criminal penalties. I doubt it. I think school zones, for various reasons, probably have a separate kind of connotation for people in terms of places where if you do something wrong, you're really going to be in trouble. You know, we don't have to have that. I guess maybe the federal government takes care of that for airports. And other kinds of places like that. So I understand kind of the cultural shift. But I guess what I'm struggling with is just the lack of examples of people doing something wrong, being charged with a crime, and feeling that somehow the penalties weren't adequate under current law, or evidence that somehow violence has retreated somehow in these other places that have been designated in this way. I just want to be very careful about increasing penalties because we recognize a problem and feel like we want to do something without being really clear that what we're doing is actually tailored to the problem that we have and will have some impact on it.
Okay. Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill. Just some helpful advice. The possession actually would include people who bring drugs as part of the hospital when they were coming to seek treatment. So the way that it just adding it would include that group. And if you're trying to get employee theft of drugs, you don't have the 150 or you don't have the 60952 theft statute included in your enhanced penalty. Okay. So you're not actually getting people who steal the narcotics. You'd get it for possessing it in the building, but not necessarily for actually stealing it. That's the 60952 statute, and you don't have that in here. So you might want to think about those two pieces. And I've heard that there's a fiscal note requested, but we don't yet have it. And do we know from sentencing guidelines yet at all if there's any round numbers that we'd be talking about?
Mr. Chair.
No,
we don't have any information yet back on the fiscal, unfortunately. So that's why part of the reason why we're laying it over, just to see what the fiscal looks like. And thank you for those other two points. We'll look at that, too, and see what we can do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other testifiers?
I do not.
Any other comments from the public? Okay, Representative O'Neill, any closing statement by you for your bill?
It's a really, really difficult thing in the hospitals when, you know, as you pointed out, Representative Ward, you've got people that are trying to help and you have medical attention, and the violence has just been continuing to increase. And I know it's a complex problem coming from the mental health field myself. It's an incredibly complex problem. And, the point behind this bill was not to further penalize people that are in the middle of a mental health crisis or in the middle of a drug episode, but that's about 50% of the violence in the workplace, and this would address the other 50%. And I'd love to work on some other bills to get at some of the other issues as well, but this is my bill for today to see if we can't at least change the culture within the hospital, because I think people come in and, yes, they're not feeling well, and there's a culture of, you know, just kind of let it all hang out and you just do whatever you do, and there's just not a whole lot of consequences. So I think changing that culture is really what is at the crux of this bill. And if we could do that, I think we can take workplace violence, head it in the other direction finally, because it's been escalating and growing. So I really appreciate your support. And with that, I guess I'd like to renew my motion.
Okay. Representative O'Neill renews their motion to have House File 1088 be held over for possible inclusion. And with that, we'll lay the bill over. Thank you very much, Bill. GOP members, we're going to meet in 500 North right now after we adjourn. Any questions? Okay, with that, we're adjourned.